Welcome to MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Peter Zion to the broadcast. Peter is a geopolitical strategist as well as an expert in global energy, demography, and security, whose worldview marries the realities of geography and populations to a deep understanding of how global politics impact markets and economic trends. Peter's career has ranged from working for the U.S. State Department in Australia to the D.C. think tank community to helping develop the analytical models for Stratfor, one of the world's premier private intelligence companies. Peter founded his own firm, Zion on Geopolitics, in 2012 to provide a select group of clients with direct custom analytical products. His first book, The Accidental Superpower, debuted in 2014, and his next book, Shale New World, will be released later this month. Peter has an undergraduate degree in political science from Truman State University and completed postgraduate studies at the University of Otago in New Zealand and the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce. I recently caught up with Peter in his office in Austin, Texas, and our conversation covered the U.S.'s changing role in global security and trade, the precipitating factors responsible for these changes, the dominance of the U.S. as a superpower given global changes in geopolitics, demography, and energy production, the sectors that will be changed most based on the factors identified, the reasons why Mexico is uniquely positioned for continued growth, as well as a variety of other topics.
This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much.
Peter, in your book, The Accidental Superpower, you talked about what has been correct for the past 70 years is about to be completely wrong, and that there are a variety of rules that we've come to take as a given that are going to be changed with regard to geopolitics, economics, etc. And especially in light of the recent election, I'd be curious about how some of the theses that you had posited in that book, which remain, which are amplified, which are changed, and so forth.
Sure. A couple things going on simultaneously. First of all, in the background, the world has become extremely unbalanced. Because of demographic aging on a global scale, the United States really is emerging as the only market over the long term. China's having this moment in the sun as the first child policy kind of grinds to its end. You've had a narrowing of their demographic. So everybody who's 20 and under is a very, very small generation in China. So we're seeing this consumption boom among people aged 20 to 30. Those are the people who normally do most of the purchasing, but that's it. That's the end. And that's, aside from the United States, the last gasp of global consumption. So all of the market is going to be here. That's one. Number two, the United States is backing away from the world. The United States is sick of involving itself in Middle Eastern wars. You're looking already at a downsizing of the army as we right-size our military for less adventurous projects. And that's going to reduce the American footprint overseas at the same time that the United States' ability to intervene actually increases. With what we've done with special forces, what we're doing with drones, what we're doing with satellite tech, the United States' ability to reach out is actually higher than it has been for decades. But our need to do that with troops on the ground or maintaining the day-to-day order of the international system is going away. Then you've got Trump, who comes in and takes a lot of the trends that already existed in American politics and just kind of kicks them up a notch. We're already going into this period of new isolationism, and here comes in a trade warrior who wants to renegotiate every trade deal on the books, specifically fingering Mexico and China, who are two of our three biggest trading partners. You put those three things together, and you get a United States that has is transitioning from being the global guarantor of security and the global guarantor of global trade and the global guarantor of energy markets to one that at best has stepped back from it all and more likely even sees a vested interest in disrupting it to a certain degree. At the same time, the U.S. is the only market. So the split between successful countries and failed countries in the future is how well can you buddy up with the only country that matters? Because everything else is going to be a free-for-all. But in the United States, you've got the market, you've got the financial capital, you've got the labor system, you've got the consumption base, you've got the energy, and you've got the ability to project power out rather than have to defend your own borders. That doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet and isn't going to exist anywhere else on the planet in the next 50 years. The only question in my mind for the last few years has been, what is the speed of the transition? Well, under a President Hillary Clinton, it would have taken 4 to 8 years. Under President Donald Trump, it'll probably take 4 to 8 months. So 2017 is shaping up to be the most dynamic year in international affairs since at least 1945.
Are you suggesting that some of what we're seeing with the Trump bounce or the positive reaction to the markets in the U.S. as symptomatic or emblematic of some of the positive changes for the U.S., at least in terms of economically, that those are sustainable from your perspective?
Well, as a rule, I try to stay out of commenting on market movements. I wouldn't bet too much on any specific economic trend that seems to be manifesting on Wall Street on the last couple of weeks. The market had fully positioned itself for Clinton victory. And when that didn't happen, everyone is scrambling in every other direction that they can possibly imagine, thinking that there might be a play there. And this is without Trump actually having announced any firm policies yet. So I would advise not getting too excited about that. Whether or not Trump's economic plans are good for the mid and the long term, we'll have to wait and see what those plans are, because we really don't know yet. Mm-hmm. The three things that Trump says he's going to attack in his first couple of months are corporate tax reform. That's pretty solid. And I think there's actually a surprising amount of bipartisan support for that in Congress already. If we had had any president other than Obama, I have no doubt that it would have made it through already. Number two is healthcare. That will be a hell of a fight. But with control over Congress, the executive branch, and probably very soon the courts, that is one that Trump can win, just probably not in the first 30 days. And then the third one is immigration, which in the first stage, it's going to be about capacity building. Because if he really is serious about doing mass deportations, then you're going to need a fair overhaul and bulking up of INS. And that's not something you can do in a month. That's something you might be able to start spinning up. Those three policies aren't going to generate short-term results. We will not see the first economic outcome for that for 2 years.
You've also talked about the pivot from Europe to Asia due to the fact that we have the advantage of having major population hubs, both in the Atlantic and the Pacific. We have the advantage of making a choice as to which direction we point ourselves. It would seem as though that drive towards an emphasis on the Pacific nations as opposed to the Atlantic partners of the past century, essentially, might be held up or might take a different trajectory given some of what we've heard about with regard to trade policy. Again, not concrete proposals that have been put in place, but as you point out, a different perspective in terms of trade agreements and policy with regard to China, among other nations in Asia. Beyond the rhetoric, do you see the U.S. continuing to have more of an emphasis towards Asia as opposed to Europe?
Well, actually, I would argue that the United States has not had a meaningful foreign policy towards either East Asia or Western Europe since the Bush administration, and that's Bush Senior, not Bush Junior. The Clinton administration didn't have a foreign policy. The GW administration, it was all Middle East all the time. And the Obama administration, the Russian reset and the pivot towards Asia were basically just a little bit of window dressing to cover the fact that we were canceling our Middle East policy. So we have really not had a functional foreign policy in any meaningful sense of the term now for 25 years. Okay. In my view, the two areas that it makes the most sense for the United States to engage in a constructive manner are Latin America, specifically Mexico, and Southeast Asia, specifically Singapore, Thailand, and Indonesia, and Myanmar and Vietnam. These are the parts of the world that have good demography and where a combination of local consumptive capacity could really marry well with American technology and military policy. So you could see serious economic booms in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, both with the United States being hip deep involved. Anywhere else in the world, you're going to be dealing with collapsing demography. So there's no market to access. You're going to be dealing with a lot of military conflict, civil breakdown, blood feuds. You go to the Persian Gulf, you're going to be in the middle of a Saudi-Iranian knife fight. You go into Europe, you have to deal with the Russian resurgence. You go into East Asia, you have to deal with what is brewing up to be a Japan, Korea, Taiwan, China fight. You don't have to deal with that in Southeast Asia. Half the population is under 30. You don't have to deal with that with Mexico, which is already the U.S.'s number one or number two trade partner based on how you do the data. These two regions are easy. They don't have a lot of heartburn, and they offer a lot in terms of resources and market.
That's interesting. You talk about the chaos that in most of the other countries for the various factors that you mentioned. The U.S. has essentially been, some might refer to it as the policeman for the world when conflicts arise. And you're speaking of a pullback from that, perhaps a pull out of that role. What does that mean that you've already begun to allude to sort of increased conflict and potentially increased war? That's a trend you see sort of continuing for the decades to come?
Oh, for at least a couple decades. Let me go back a little bit and talk about why the United States is the world's policeman. Before World War II, trade was different than it is now. It used to be that you didn't trade with your neighbors if you could help it, because that would expose you to gangly international supply chains, and any military conflict anywhere in the world could disrupt those chains, even if you weren't the target of the war. So you kept everything in-house. If you saw something you needed, you didn't trade for it, you expanded into empire. You used your navy to protect your internal trade between your colonies and your mainland. That's how it was. Those empires competed, those competitions turned into wars, that ultimately turned into World War II, which brought the whole system crashing down. And as the United States was the only country involved in the war that had no fighting on its soil, the United States was able to impose a replacement system at Bretton Woods in 1944. And Bretton Woods worked fundamentally different. Instead of everybody having their own sequestered imperial economy, everything was put into a global bucket, and everyone who was represented at Bretton Woods could access that bucket for resources and for markets. And the U.S. Navy guaranteed the security of the seas for absolutely everyone. This had never been attempted before. And it worked for two reasons. One, the U.S. did the protecting, and two, the U.S., whose market survived the war, we opened that market to all of the allies, allowing them to export their way back to affluence. We did this not because we were nice. We did this because we were basically bribing up an alliance. The catch of Bretton Woods, if you wanted all of this access, you had to allow the United States to fight the Cold War its way. You had to join the United States in containing the Soviets. Worked really well. And it was very easy to expand this network to other allies. So we started with the wartime allies. We eventually expanded it to the Axis in the 50s, Latin America, Northern Europe, Scandinavians, eventually brought in Southeast Asia. And by the time we got to the end of the Cold War, you had over half the global system that was part of this network. The problem is, Americans were so impressed with the end of the Cold War that we rewarded the government by ejecting it and picking the domestic candidate. So we went from Herbert Walker Bush to Bill Clinton. And in the next seven elections, we selected the domestic candidate. So the free trade aspect of Bretton Woods was allowed to linger on. But the security quid pro quo, which was the American justification for it in the first place, that fell by the wayside. And for the last 25 years, we've been bit by bit backing away from that system. That's made the world a lot more chaotic. That's allowed things like Syria to happen. That's allowed things like the Japanese financial crisis and the European financial crisis to happen. Had any of these things happened in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, the United States would have stepped in with a massive financial and or military involvement to stymie it. We're not doing that anymore. And so you have a lot of these military conflicts around the world that are breaking out. Brushfire wars are turning into civil wars. Civil wars are leading into breakdown. And we're now today at the verge of both an American withdrawal from active management, as well as all of these secondary powers that have been sublimated under Bretton Woods, who have had their security and their economic security provided for them for basically free of charge, now starting to have to look out after their own affairs. And most of them are not ready. And of those that are, they're not the kind of countries that we normally associate with ones that we want to be world leaders. So the Russians are breaking out of their shell and surging influence into Central Europe. That is going to provoke a response from Sweden and Germany, probably Turkey too. As the Americans withdraw from the Persian Gulf, that leaves it up to the Iranians and the Saudis to duke it out over who's in charge. And the oil price war of the last 2 years is just the opening rounds of that. Syria is a piece of that. And the next stage is some sort of energy crisis, either triggered by Saudi Arabia or Iran or Poland or Russia. If any of those four countries decide to use energy as a weapon, you're talking a minimum of 2 million barrels of crude going offline, perhaps as much as 25. Then you get an energy crisis, and that means that the Chinese and the Japanese have to fight for whatever cargoes they can access. So one way or another, the global system that we're all so used to, that we just assume operates on autopilot, is going to break down. And if Trump lives up to his rhetoric and his pullback is as aggressive as it looks like it's going to be, you know, this next year's the year.
Very interesting. You've talked about, and you've already begun to take us through three of the hypotheses you have that you highlighted in your book, The Accidental Superpower, the reassertion of geopolitics as the rule by which the world operates, global demographic inversions, and the one we've yet to talk about, shale energy, making the U.S. energy independent and in many ways being part of the lubricant of a lot of what you've just described. Can you walk us through these three hypotheses and the importance for what you're describing in terms of the U.S.'s position for the foreseeable future?
Sure, and let's do it in that order. So first, geopolitics. Policy, culture, finance, everything is shaped by physical geography. Some countries have extreme advantages over others. If you have a lot of flat lands and if you have a lot of rivers for natural transport corridors, it's very easy to develop and expand. Cost of moving goods on water is about 1/12 what it is on land. And obviously, you don't have to pay for the river in the first place. So countries like France or Germany or Japan or the United States have a massive leg up in their ability to generate financial, economic, industrial, agricultural power. And that translates into everything else that they do and makes them major military powers as well. Bretton Woods made that not matter because it put everybody in the same club. It told countries that they couldn't use military power to impress their will upon others. Free trade gave everybody access. Free movement of capital made the countries that were relatively capital poor, whether they're Brazil or India or Spain, allowed them to function as strong secondary powers for the first time in history. And a lot of countries that didn't even exist pre-Bretton Woods suddenly could, because you didn't have to worry about the regional hegemons conquering everybody. So the Austro-Hungarian Empire gave birth to 15 different countries. The German sphere of influence could exist as an economic entity without threatening anyone because the Germans were no longer a military power. Japan got everything they wanted with the co-prosperity sphere because the Americans gave it to them, not because they conquered it themselves. So all of these things and economic competition that had driven imperial competition for centuries, everybody suddenly got it for free. So, I mean, everybody joined the Bretton Woods system because it was a really good deal. You remove Bretton Woods, and it all starts up again. The Germans start having to look after their own interests. The Japanese can't rely on the protection of the American Navy and freedom of the seas for their imports and their exports. The Chinese, who are probably the biggest beneficiary of Bretton Woods, actually have to go back to their 4,000 years of internal strife because they lack projection capacity. They're caged by their own geography. And this story is going to repeat over and over and over across the world as all of those secondary powers that used to be major empires all of a sudden have to start acting imperial again. And that's going to generate everything from energy crises to famines, to military conflicts. So that's number one. Number two is demography. People of different ages act differently. People in their 20s and 30s, it's all about consumption. They're having kids, they're buying cars, they're buying houses. It's a lot of spending. This is most of the consumption of the modern economy. This is most of the economic activity. But they're starting out. They're very new to the world. Their incomes are low. So it's house loans, it's car loans, it's college loans. So high growth, but also high debt. Your mature workers, 40s, 50s, 60s, the house is mostly paid for. The kids are moving out. There aren't a lot of new consumption bursts out of them. It's pretty steady. But they're preparing for retirement, and their incomes are very high. So this is all the investment capital that makes the world move. This is the tax base. Without the mature workers, you wouldn't have a modern economy because you wouldn't have the funding necessarily to make it happen. So young folks do the consuming. The older folks take care of the investment capital and fund the governments. And then finally, your retirees can't take the volatility, so they step back. Stocks and bonds become T-bills and cash. And very soon, they start drawing more from the system than they put in. So pensions and healthcare really start to overwhelm their finances and become a problem for governments. Now, in a traditional demography, the elderly are the smallest group. The folks in the middle are larger, and then the young workers make up the bulk. It's a pyramid. But with urbanization and the post-World War II experience, we've had a collapse in birth rate throughout most of the world. So in places like Germany, there are more people in their 50s than 40s than 30s than 20s than teenagers than children. The demography is completely inverted in a lot of the world, and it's not limited to the West. You've got the same thing going on in Brazil. You've got the same thing going on in Russia, same thing going on in China. So we're at this moment right now where the big bulge in the demography isn't the young workers, it's the mature workers, people who are nearing retirement around the world. Those are the baby boomer generation. Right now, they're socking away a lot of capital for retirement, and they're paying huge taxes just because of the size of the generation. So governments the world over are flush with capital right now. And the stock market, the bond market, is completely flush with capital. And that's driven down the cost of money, the cost of borrowing on a global basis, and made the investment boom of 2000 until today possible. But by the time you get to 2022, the majority of the baby boomers will have retired. And they'll take all that investment capital and all that tax money with them. And every government on the planet is going to have to get by with a lot less income. At the same time, they have to dish out a lot more payments for the retirees. So we're on the right now, we're in this absolute capital bubble. And in less than a decade, we're going to be in a complete capital shortage. There's only one country in the world that is an exception to that, and that's the United States. Because in the U.S., we are the only place where the boomers actually had kids. Those are the millennials. They're doing a lot of consumption right now. All that beard butter and all those flip-flops, you know, it adds up. That consumption is probably why we haven't been in recession for the last 2 years. But the millennials everywhere else are a smaller generation. Only here are they large. In fact, everywhere else, the millennial generation is actually smaller than Gen X. So right now, we're in a world courtesy of the boomers, where the U.S. is the world's largest financial power, and courtesy of the millennials, the U.S. is the largest consumption power. You fast forward just a few years, and the U.S. is the only financial power and only consumption power. Now, getting from here to there, we have to digest the boomer retirement. We're looking at 10 to 15 years of stressed financial capacity, but we come out on the other end all right, because the millennial generation is large. And by the time they are in their 40s and 50s, our demographics more or less fix themselves, but that doesn't happen anywhere else. Everywhere else, the population gets older every year, the population gets less skilled every other year, financial costs go up every year. So the European financial crisis, the Japanese financial crisis, they are as good as they will ever be right now, and it's all downhill from here. So at the same time that the United States is losing interest in maintaining the global system, the same time the global structure breaks down, the United States is becoming the only market in the world, and it's going to be keeping to itself. And so that's a triple hit to every economy in the world. And if you're a trade-based economy, like Korea, or like China, or like Germany, you get hit from every possible angle at the same time. So that's two, demography. Number three is shale. Wow, it's hard to overstate what is going on in the industry right now. So let me just kind of give you the quick version. It all comes down to full cycle break-even prices. How much does it cost to get a barrel of crude on average out of the ground, including everything from exploration on the front end to production costs to midstream piping to taxes on the back end? And in the big four shale fields in the United States, the break-even price is now about $40 a barrel. So U.S. shale, what we've always thought of as the really expensive stuff, is now cost competitive with every energy basin in the world outside of the Persian Gulf itself. And there's a whole suite of new technologies, things like refracking and multilateral drilling and in-drilling and water tanks that are coming together to make a new best practices suite, merging with big data. And that price structure is still going down. And by the time we get to January 2019, we will probably be about $25 a barrel. So because of that cost structure, you are seeing U.S. energy output increasing despite weak prices. And unless there's a complete, unless the bottom falls out of the oil markets and we go down to $20, I see no reason for that to change. If anything, it looks like it's about to accelerate again. If you look at North America as a whole, the total continent need for accessing global energy markets is now less than 2 million barrels per day. That's about 1/7 of what it was just 10 years ago. Functionally, North America is already energy independent. And even if we would have had a President Clinton that would have constricted fracking a little bit, we would have still gotten there. Under President Trump, you'll probably see federal lands open up. Keep in mind, there's almost no shale activity going on in federal lands because the regulatory process is so slow. It can take 6 months to get a drilling permit, where in Texas, it usually takes about 16 hours, just to kind of give you a comparison. You will undoubtedly see North America achieving full energy independence within a couple of years. And with a little tweak of a price structure, by the end of this term, it is entirely possible that not just North America will be energy independent, but the United States itself might be very close.
Very interesting. You've also talked about three sectors that are going to be impacted more than any others on a more sustained basis. You've called out finance, manufacturing, and agribusiness. Can you talk a bit about why that's the case?
Sure. With finance, it's pretty straightforward. Because of the demographic shift, the United States is the only country that is going to be generating a lot of its own internal financial heft. We have more of a balance between our retirees, our mid-age workers, and our young workers, whereas everybody else is just kind of aging into this mass retirement. Old folks' homes don't generate a lot of economic activity. They don't generate a lot of capital. And for most of the world, particularly Japan and Western Europe, that's all they've got. So that's piece one of finance. The second piece is almost as important. As the world breaks down, money's mobile. And I'm not just talking electronically, I'm literally talking cash in suitcases. And we're already seeing a surge of skilled migrants moving away from countries that are in the economic doldrums, moving away from places where civil breakdown's starting to happen, to the United States. So we're getting the cream of the global crop, and they're coming with their own degrees, and they're coming with their own money. Based on whose numbers you use and how you define net versus gross, in calendar year 2015, there was $800 billion of capital flight from the Eurozone, another $800 billion of capital flight from China into North America. And 90% of that ended up in the United States. So we're in the least bad situation from a demographic point of view, which guarantees financial supremacy. And because of American stability versus the rest of the world, we're basically importing everybody else's capital, and they just want to keep it safe. This is the only place to put it. Manufacturing, also two big factors in play. The first one, of course, is demographics. If you are the only major consumption center, most countries, most companies want to pre-position their productive facilities as close to the end consumer as possible so they can get on the right side of security risk and currency risk. So if you look at countries like Japan, if you look at companies like Toyota, their biggest facilities are in the United States now. And you're seeing an echo of that with everything from Volkswagen to Daewoo, with companies just trying to get on the right side of international borders as things break down. The second is a little bit more complicated. As military activity ticks up and as the seas become less safe, and especially as the United States backs away from guaranteeing maritime transport, you're going to have a change in the way things are assembled. Pre-Bretton Woods, you built things differently. You'd have giant industrial cities, industrial complexes, vast facilities, where inputs would be brought in, they'd be processed into basic, intermediate, and finished goods all in the same area, and then those goods would be exported. You did this because you couldn't risk international supply chains. You never knew when they were going to be disrupted. Enter Bretton Woods. The seas become safe. Finance is easy. You can build industrial plant anywhere, and any place that can indicate that it can make a widget efficiently will get the facility. And instead of building things in one place, you would break up that production cycle into supply chains that were several dozens, hundreds, maybe even thousands of steps long. Today's iPhone has 22 major components. And if you include the subcomponents, you touch 130 countries and over 2,000 facilities. That's all going away. Because 3/4 of the world's supply chains are in Northern Europe, where you have to deal with the Russian fight, or Northeast Asia, where you have to deal with the Chinese and the Japanese flight. Supply chains have to collapse. We're on the verge of a world where input, production, and consumption don't just need to be physically protected, they need to be co-located. And right now, the only place that happens is North America. So we've already seen a fairly substantial reshoring process from China to North America since 2008. That's about 4 million jobs. Expect that to double down really quick. Agribusiness is pretty basic. When you make international transport safe, you allow countries that don't have the ability to grow a lot of food to make something else. So Egypt got into cotton. Korea started making cars and washing machines. And they can use the import earnings from those products to then purchase food on international markets. Well, the international markets for both those exports and the imports are going away. Not to mention that the ability of countries to import fertilizer, pesticides, and herbicides is going to be constrained. And so if you look at the countries that import all of this crop, you know, these are countries that have had the fastest population growth over the last 60 years. That's all going to unwind. And if you look at the countries that have joined the ranks of the major agricultural powers in the last 60 years, these are countries that can't do it without imported capital and imported input. So you're looking at probably a 30 to 40% reduction in the ability of the world to grow food, much less transport it to end markets, much less those end markets' ability to pay for it in the first place. So we are staring down famine that is continental in scope that will probably hit Asia and Africa the hardest. If you're in a country that has a net export capacity for foodstuffs and has the military capacity to make sure that those crops get to their end destination, you're set. But you know, there's really only a few countries that fall into that category. There's only six countries in the world that can expand their agricultural footprint. That's New Zealand, Australia, Myanmar, Argentina, France, and the United States. And of those, really only Australia, New Zealand, France, and the United States can guarantee shipments of food products. So if you're a farmer in one of those countries, you are set because you're going to have access to a starving world that will pay whatever it can to get your output. Reliability will be key, and you can guarantee that. No one else can. So we've got the final years of this investment boom are still going to be hard for agriculture because you've got a lot of competition that has been artificially stabilized by the system. But you remove that artificial stabilization, the amount of money you can make in farming is astronomical. The last time we had something like this, it was the Napoleonic conflicts of the early 1800s. All of the major food producers in Europe were at war more or less at the same time. And so you had famine across Europe. That's the same time that the American farmers started producing in large quantities. They'd ship out to the Mississippi, down to New Orleans, off to Europe, bring in hard currency. It was the greatest economic expansion ever in human history. And the spare capital that we had from that paid for the entirety of the railway revolution. We're on the cusp of something just as grand.
Last time we spoke was in September, so pre-election. And at the time, you mentioned that the fastest growing economy for the next 30 years would be Mexico. I wonder, first of all, if any change as a result of the election, and assuming that some, if not all of the basis of that reasoning stands, I wonder if you could walk us through the advantages that Mexico has.
Well, let me first explain why I think Mexico. The countries that are going to do very well in the future have a couple of factors going for them. One, they've got a relatively young population, so they can consume a surprising proportion of what they produce, generate their own growth to a certain degree. Second, they need to have no international security issues, so they can't be involved in any of the military conflicts that are about to rack the system. And third, they need the ability to participate in local or regional supply chains that kind of give them economies of scale and allow them to tap technology and capital from other sources. And the three countries that I anticipate being able to do that the best in no particular order are Myanmar, Indonesia, and Mexico. Now, in addition to having those things going for it, Mexico also has a number of other advantages. First, it is hardwired into the American energy system now. And so they're importing a lot of the waste natural gas that comes out of the shale field. So they're able to electrify their system in a way that they've never done before. And power outages are probably going to be a thing of the past in the next couple of years. So that was the single biggest thing holding back their industry, and it's just about taken care of. Brexit really helps them out. Because if the Canadians get their way, the United Kingdom isn't just going to have a free trade agreement with Canada and a separate one with the United States. They're going to get into NAFTA. And if you take 65 million first world customers and merge them with the NAFTA system, Mexico is definitely the country that would benefit the most from that. Third, labor costs. Even in today's environment, even without the global trade breakdown, Mexico is already cost competitive with everybody in Southeast Asia. In fact, Mexican labor is now not only more skilled, it's half the cost of Chinese labor. So all that reshoring, Mexico is the number one beneficiary. With the trade breakdown, Mexico is already in the NAFTA system. It has a separate agreement with the United States outside of global trade rules that aren't going to be threatened by the U.S. withdrawal. But obviously, what happens with the Trump administration is going to be critical. But let me start by saying that from an economic point of view, there is no argument that trade with Mexico is bad. You don't produce things in Mexico and ship them to the United States. You have a supply chain with parts manufacturers on both sides of the border, with assembly on both sides of the border. The Mexicans basically take things that require less skill and less capital. The Americans take the parts of the chain that are more highly value added. For every job you generate in Mexico, you probably generate three or four in the United States. So Mexico is absolutely not stealing jobs, but it's a political issue. When people see a low-skilled facility in the United States pick up and go to Mexico, you then have a community in the United States that doesn't have that high value added capacity that all of a sudden is destitute. So it becomes a political question, even if the overall gain for the United States is substantial. We haven't done a good job at retraining these people. We haven't been done a good job of providing them with other options. And that has generated a lot of the angst that led to the Trump phenomenon. The question is, how will Mexico handle this? Because if you let Trump and Trump's team drive the question, then yeah, you very easily could see meaningful trade barriers. I don't think it would lead to a American flat-out rejection of the NAFTA accord, but it could be a reinterpretation of a lot of informal barriers and ignoring of the adjudication process that could really hurt not just Mexico, but the United States. I've seen some very proactive thinking out of Mexico City in the last couple of weeks about them looking to engage the United States in a broad-scale renegotiation of the agreement. You know, it's probably time. NAFTA was negotiated in 1990 to 1993. It's already been 20 years. It's time for us to get NAFTA 2, whatever that might look like. And something that the W. Bush administration started just before 9/11 was NAFTA 2, starting to include security issues with the NAFTA accords. Immigration was part of that package. So this is something we've talked about before, and the Mexicans are bringing it to the table in an attempt to steer the talks. I think it's a very astute move. We just don't know what the Trump administration is going to do. Trade and Mexico were not listed on the topics that he wanted to tackle in his first month. That tells me we've got a little bit of time. That tells me that there's options for wiggle room. And if you look at a lot of the campaign promises that he's already walked back, I think it's pretty hopeful that we're going to be able to have some sort of progress on this that pacifies some of the more ardent anti-trade folks without trashing the U.S.-Mexico relationship, which I think would be bad for everybody. It's all a question of how you manage it. Now, in my personal view, there is going to be a wall, but I don't think it's going to be on the northern border. Most of the illegal immigration that has flowed into the United States since the financial crisis hasn't been from Mexico. In fact, net migration for the last 3 years from Mexico has been negative. More Mexicans have moved back than have come to the United States. But if you look at Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador and the rest, it's all Central American migrants that are coming up to the United States. Now, a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border, that would be 2,000 miles long. That is beyond the capacity of the United States to patrol in an effective manner. It would basically hand over the border to the smugglers because they could more easily punch through it. But Mexico's southern borders, that's only about 500 miles. It's already rugged terrain. You could fortify that. And the funny thing about Mexico is they're actually far more paranoid about illegal migration than we are. So that's something that the two countries probably could have a pretty constructive relationship on if they can get past the rhetoric at the top level.
Peter Zion, thank you so much for taking time today and sharing your perspectives. It's been a great conversation.
My pleasure.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on world-class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world-class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.